From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And the Senate is expected to start voting any minute now on Betsy DeVos's nomination as Secretary of Education. Last night, there was an all-night protest by Democrats on the Senate floor. And Michigan's Debbie Stabenow told CNN that Democrats felt they may have one more Republican to join the two who've come forward willing to vote against the controversial nominee. But the thinking is that it will be a tie, and the vice president, as is tradition, will break it. First time ever for a cabinet nominee if that happens. And presumably Mike Pence will back President Trump's pick. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving is here. Ron, a tie, is that what you're expecting?
Yes, it is. We still don't have a third Republican name. Only Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Senator Susan Collins of Maine have said that they would vote against Betsy DeVos, and they both said that they did not feel she was qualified. And there may be other Republicans who feel the same way, but none has come forward to say that they would vote against her. So we're still waiting, and actually the voting has begun in the Senate as we speak.
You know, and this is despite an outpouring of scorn. DeVos was skewered in that Saturday Night Live skit last weekend, especially because of a moment in the real hearings when she didn't seem to know the difference between academic growth and proficiency. I'm going to put it way too simply. Growth is social growth, individual growth. Proficiency is academic, something you test, something dear to educators. Did not know that. Or when she said guns might belong in rural schools to protect against potential grizzlies. Why, given this, you know, why are Republicans holding to this nomination?
Yes, the irony is that Murkowski and Collins come from two states where they might actually have bears that might attack someone, probably not a school in all likelihood. That was a strange moment. There were a number of moments in the DeVos hearings that were not covered in glory and have been lampooned. She had an unsteady performance. But perhaps the more important thing in the long run is that she has a longstanding perceived antipathy towards certainly teacher unions and also towards public education, which she's been very critical of, despite not having actually been involved in public education herself, and she has also not held public office. She is a very wealthy woman, married a billionaire, and there is also the sense that many of the contributions that the DeVos family has made to Republican politicians over the years have played a role.
Okay, well, that vote for DeVos has just gotten started. We'll keep an ear on that. But meantime, another big story this week, the ongoing legal battle around Donald Trump's travel bans. Oral arguments are set for 6 p.m. tonight in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Tell us more about that and what happens after that.
All day today, we expect the emergency panel of three judges from the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco to be studying the briefs that they received yesterday morning and yesterday evening from the two sides of this struggle. Now, what we have here are, on one hand, the attorneys general from Washington State and Minnesota, and they have gotten this order from the Seattle federal judge that is now before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And of course, Washington, D.C., the Justice Department for Donald Trump, is arguing that that judge in Seattle was way out of line and that the president has so much information about classified information about terror threats that the courts really need to back off and defer to him and let him decide what our immigration policy should be, even if that might be perceived by some. And of course, the Justice Department does not concede this is the purpose. Perceived by some as a ban on Muslims entering the country.
Right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. Meanwhile, Donald Trump, the president, getting a lot of pushback in the last 24 hours after falsely claiming that journalists have been reluctant to report terror attacks around the world and then releasing a list of terror attacks that some might say have been overly covered. Speaker of the House Paul Ryan was asked about these comments at a news conference this morning.
I can't speak to whether or not you're over or under reporting something. That's your job. I'll stick with doing mine.
Look, Ron, the list that the White House used is reportedly from the alt-right website InfoWars. As we said, most journalists are demonstrating that in most of the cases, the Paris attacks, San Bernardino, Orlando, some have said up to 80% of those listed have been fully covered. Some more obscure ones have not. What's going on here?
Some of the more obscure ones, for example, the very first one on the list is a knife-slashing attack in Melbourne, Australia, a couple of years ago, where a couple of police officers were injured. No one was killed. Some of these are rather remote from the United States and, again, did not involve actual deaths or, for that matter, even gunfire. And many of the publications that normally cover any kind of a terror attack quite thoroughly have gone back in their files and found that they did actually report even these more minor incidents. USA Today is still checking some of their files, but says that they've covered the overwhelming majority of them. I think the main reaction in the media to this is just bewilderment. I mean, saying that the media don't cover terror attacks for whatever reason, it's like saying CNN would not cover a missing airliner.
Yeah. Okay, back to Paul Ryan's news conference, I just want to touch on something he focused mostly on, which was the push by Republicans to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And he went on to say that, look, the country was promised that we would do something. Things are getting worse. More and more we see this law collapsing. But in Donald Trump's pre-Super Bowl interview, the president was more vague than ever on the timeline of repeal and replacing Obamacare, and other Republicans are using repair. Where are we on that?
Yes. Yes, that word repair has certainly cropped up. Lamar Alexander, chairman of a powerful health committee in the Senate, has started using that word. We've heard gradualism creeping into even Paul Ryan's language as he's talked about trying to get the markets in the right place for the actual replacement to take place. And it's at this juncture clear that they have not agreed upon what the president describes as our wonderful plan will actually be, and it's going to take some months to decide that and to sell it to all the Republicans.
NPR's Ron Elving, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, the Army Corps of Engineers could reach a decision this week on an easement that would allow Energy Transfer Partners to complete the Dakota Access Pipeline. The pipeline would transport oil from western North Dakota to refineries in Illinois. Proponents, including President Trump, say it would be good for the economy. Opponents include members of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, whose reservation is located near the pipeline. The controversy has now extended to Seattle, where today the city council is expected to cut ties with Wells Fargo, in part because the bank is a lender for the project. The city does about $3 billion worth of business with the bank each year. Paige Browning from Here and Now contributor KUOW reports.
Protests in Seattle against the Dakota Access Pipeline project have been large and frequent. They're often organized by local tribal members.
So when we come up here and we say, Miniwichoni, what do you say?
Water is life!
Miniwichoni!
Water is life!
Yes, it is.
Protesters share the concerns of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, which says the pipeline would threaten tribal water supplies, land, and cultural sites. Seattle City Council is on record against the project, but Wells Fargo, the bank that the city does most of its business with, is among 17 lenders for the pipeline. That's not sitting well with city leaders, especially after the bank's recent scandal over opening accounts without customer knowledge. Socialist City Council member Shama Sawant has led the charge for Seattle to divest from Wells Fargo.
For taking on this issue, and this is not just about Seattle, this is about our global fight against climate change and the oil lobby.
Her bill prohibits any city business with Wells Fargo once the city's contract with the bank expires at the end of 2018. For Wells Fargo's part, a spokesperson says they're proud of the support they've given Seattle. Mary Nell is Wells Fargo's commercial banking manager for Washington.
There have been a number of areas where, you know, we can continue to do better. And when we make mistakes, we own up to it and, you know, we make improvements. So, and it is disappointing to us that they've taken this approach.
They, meaning the Seattle City Council. Wells Fargo has also lost business recently with the City of Chicago and the University of California system, and the Navajo Nation is considering cutting ties. University of Washington business professor Abhinav Gupta says corporate boycotts may not immediately affect a company financially, but Gupta says that's often not the point.
And consumer boycotts often, they are initiated by a small group of consumers who directly would not be able to alter companies' cost-benefit analysis, but at the same time, the negative reputation that they generate or reputational harm that they generate is often enough to get companies to react.
And that might be what's happening with Wells Fargo. Spokesperson Mary Nell says the bank has changed a few practices already.
We have enhanced our due diligence on projects such as this to include more research into, you know, whether indigenous communities are affected and how and that they have been properly consulted.
But she says the bank is bound by contract to carry out loans for the pipeline. Seattle's lawmakers realize their bill may not cancel the project, but they hope it encourages more corporate social responsibility. Councilmember Shama Sawant says whether it's protesting after the inauguration or passing new laws, it's important people speak up for their beliefs.
We've seen that the power of the ruling elite has limits, and those limits are determined by how powerful our movements are in the 99%.
I'm Paige Browning in Seattle.
The future of Obamacare is still a mystery, with President Trump saying this week that the rollout of his replacement plan may stretch into next year. Patients, hospitals, and insurers are eagerly waiting to find out the details. So are drug companies like Pfizer. And the CEO of Pfizer, Ian Reed, joins us now for our View from the Top conversation. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you.
And we've got a lot to ask you about, but let me start with, what are you expecting when it comes to the future of Obamacare? Do you think it'll be repealed or just repaired?
You know, I don't really have a clear sight on the way through. I do believe it does need to be reformed. The insurance is not good insurance for the average person. They get, high deductibles, and they don't have good access to modern medicine. So it does need reform, but I don't have a view on where it's going to go.
Well, people may be surprised to hear that the CEO of a major pharmaceutical company doesn't know exactly what's going to happen with this very important law.
Well, you know, the pharmaceutical industry is about 12% of overall healthcare costs. And while I'm aware of the impacts of that insurance on the way that medicines are covered, it's very complicated and very connected to what providers need and insurers need and payers and patients. So, you know, everybody looks at a small part of that pie, and no one really looks at it holistically.
How much does it matter to Pfizer what happens with Obamacare?
Well, in the sense that we have not seen a huge benefit to our business from the Affordable Care Act. There was a sort of implied promise from the government that, you know, if we paid all these fees and all these taxes to help fund the Affordable Care Act, there would be expanded business through the people who are getting insured. Frankly, most of the expanded insurance base do not use innovative products because the insurance is not of a great quality.
So do you think that it was overall a benefit or not to have Obamacare in the first place?
A benefit to whom? I think it was certainly it was a benefit to some patients who had no insurance and needed to get insurance, and I'm empathetic about that. That insurance could have been given to those people in a lot more efficient way, I believe, and deserved to be given to them in a lot more efficient way.
What about the issue of drug prices? We've heard from President Trump that he would negotiate drug prices down for consumers. He has since kind of backed off on that idea a bit after meeting with a number of CEOs of pharmaceutical companies. But do you think there's going to be a change in federal policy, or could be a change in federal policy, to allow the government and Medicare in particular to negotiate drug prices?
Well, let me say firstly, the drug prices are negotiated every day. You know, it's not as if you produce a new drug and you bring it to market and you say, here's my price. You know, you've got to get the Uniteds and the PBMs and the Humanas of the world to agree that your product has value and to list it informally and what position informally. So there are, you know, and Medicare is probably one of the most successful programs since its inception. It's come under 40% under budget. And I believe that the premiums per person have only increased on average about $6 since its inception. So that's an example of tremendous negotiation from the private sector to ensure that Medicare is a program that meets patients' needs. And I think it has an 80% approval by the recipients of Medicare.
But in the case of Medicare, they're banned by law from actually negotiating the prices directly.
Well, you know, the government doesn't negotiate directly, but they have third-party market-based incentives and people to do that. You know, in reality, you know, it's an oxymoron. You don't negotiate with a government. If a government controls the patients and controls all access, there is no negotiation, as you see in Europe.
Well, don't you have to negotiate with governments in Europe on prices?
Well,
directly?
As I was saying, you don't negotiate. In reality, it becomes an issue of they have the market and they say we want a price that is this, and you around the edges try and negotiate to try and recover more value so you can put it into research. But in the end, we're price takers. We're not price givers in Europe. And this is bad for the system. It means that, frankly, a large part of the world is freeloading on American innovation.
Well, explain why you think it's bad for the system, though, because presumably the people are paying less in those European countries.
Well, if you pay less, you get less. For an example, we have a great product that we discovered and registered in 2011. It's called Xalkori, the first product of its type for an ALK mutation in lung cancer. People who get it tend to be young and have never smoked. There's a guy called, what comes to my mind, who I've met, Matt Hinze, 24 years of age. On the day that he was diagnosed with this, he discovered at the same time that we had just launched this treatment. He was treated at the Cleveland Clinic in August 2011. He's still alive, and now he's on a new experimental drug for us and, you know, still doing well. But, you know, if he'd been in the UK, he would never have got the diagnostic test, and the product only came to the market a year, year and a half after that, so he wouldn't have survived. And, you know, you take this example and multiply it through hundreds of thousands, if not millions of examples in Europe, and you see a huge impact on the life and the quality of life of people.
Although there are many who would say, you know, the drug companies always bring up the issue of research and development, and we've got to have this money so we can develop new drugs. And then we see the drug companies spending a lot of money on advertising and marketing.
Well, you know, it's all about competition. If you don't advertise, there's no competition. Competition drives prices down. So I don't see that advertising as necessarily a bad thing. I see it as a positive way to ensure that patients are aware of your therapies. You know, in Europe, you can't advertise on television. Patients are kept in ignorance of therapies, which is a way that governments use to control their health bill. So, you know, it's part of our ecosystem. It's part of being American, the ability to advertise and tell people about the great products you've got.
We're speaking with Ian Reid, who is the CEO of Pfizer. And Ian Reid, how has it been as the CEO of a big company in the U.S. to deal with this new president who's gotten much more involved in individual companies? He's tweeted about individual companies. He goes after them when they don't do things that he likes.
Well, you know, I haven't had any firsthand experience of it. I think every president has his own personality and his own way of working. You know, I'm enthusiastic about some of the potential changes in the healthcare arena that he's proposing, both tax changes and both reducing regulations and trying to get American jobs back into America if he changes the tax code. And, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing how he works with Congress on that.
And, of course, your company was basically specifically targeted by the previous administration of President Obama, who wanted to use you as an example of a company that was trying to merge with an overseas company and then change their tax situation so they wouldn't have to pay as much. That merger between Pfizer and Allergan ended up not going through. But you've had some experience with being called out specifically.
Yeah, but, you know, I would like to point out that you know, what we were attempting to do there was a direct cause of the tax code in the U.S., which is so penalizes U.S. companies that have overseas companies. We were just trying to get a level playing field with our European and Asian competitors. I mean, it's absurd. If we bring money back that we've made abroad, which has already paid taxes, and we want to invest it in the U.S., sometimes we have to pay up to an extra 30% of tax. Foreign companies don't do that. They can bring back all the cash they like from overseas and invest in the U.S. without any further tax. So I was just looking for a level playing field and the ability to invest more in America.
So what's a reasonable corporate tax rate in your mind?
You know, you can argue from zero because you tax it through dividends to any level that you feel is appropriate. I think, you know, a tax is eventually paid by the consumer. And so it's really up to the politicians to decide what tax rate they want to use. I just want to have an even playing field with our international competitors.
What about the issue of regulations? We've heard Donald Trump talk about how he wants to cut back on regulations, certainly stopping new regulations. How burdensome are the regulations, for example, from the FDA for a company like Pfizer? Or are they? Or are they reasonable and they should stay the way they are?
Well, let's start with saying clearly there's a role for the FDA in making sure products are safe. And, you know, all products have a balance between their safety and how efficacious they are. So, you know, I respect that from the FDA. The problem is the FDA is incentivated by the nature of the organization to be totally risk-averse. They never get applauded. They never get congratulated because they brought a product earlier to market, like Ibrance, which is the oncology division of the FDA, which is, you know, a pretty good example of how a really good regulator should work. Brings products forward, accelerates them, gets them out to treat patients. But the FDA never gets applauded for that. They only get pilloried if the product goes wrong. So they're totally risk averse.
One more thing I want to ask you about, Ian Reed, and that is at the recent World Economic Forum gathering in Davos, 83 drug and biotech firms, including Pfizer, said it was time to work together with governments to fight the spread of drug-resistant superbugs. What's standing in the way of developing new antibiotics?
Well, you know, it's incentives. I don't think any government has ever developed a drug. They do some very, very basic research, and we hear this all the time. Oh, the government spends so much money. The NIH spends so much money. They do very basic pathway research. For instance, a drug we have out, Xeljanz, for rheumatoid arthritis. One of our scientists was at a conference of the NIH years and years ago, saw an interesting paper, took it. We had to validate the research. And then 18 years later, we have a drug. Right? So that's the issue. The issue is how fast can we move to get these drugs into the marketplace? And you know, how do we use the community in general to do that?
That's Ian Reed, the CEO of Pfizer. Ian Reed, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Poo-Pourri, the original before-you-go toilet spray that uses essential oils to trap bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water. Use it next time you have to go at work or when visiting family and friends. Poo-Pourri allows you to go anywhere with uplifting, natural fragrances like lemongrass, lavender, or hibiscus. Whether at work, on a date, even at a party, you can go. Use the code NOW and get 20% off your next purchase at poopourri.com.
And President Trump's executive order to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border has human ramifications, obviously. But conservationists and wildlife experts are concerned that animals, jaguars, mountain lions, and Mexican gray wolves are among the dozens of species, many endangered, whose lives or future survival would be under threat. Vicky Croke covers all things animals for us. And Vicky, start with a conservationist view.
Well, conservationists always talk about the fact that animals don't recognize official government borders across state lines or international ones. And we really see that in a pointed way here. Much of the border between U.S. and Mexico is already fenced, 600 plus miles. But the order for the new wall intends to close up the distance for the entire length, which is about 2,000 miles long from Texas to California. And here's some amazing essential habitat, including portions of the Sonoran Desert ecosystem. There's a terrific diversity of wildlife. Javelina or peccary, Sonoran pronghorn, carnivores including pumas, bears, ocelots, wolves, and those elusive jaguars. In the simplest terms, what we're talking about from biologists and conservationists is that the wall construction is a direct threat to wildlife.
What is the threat? Just passage?
At the most basic level, that's right. It would be incredibly disruptive, interfering with natural movement of many, cutting off traditional or regular resources for food or water, especially difficult in habitat that's susceptible to drought, and then cutting off access to mates or limiting the number of potential mates, which, of course, can have enormous consequences for species already under pressure. Mm-hmm. I spoke with Dr. Howard Quigley. He's with Panthera, and that's the Global Wildcat Conservation Organization. He's a leader in their jaguar and puma programs, and he framed the problem as casting a shadow across many species. Here's what he had to say.
A wall, especially if it's impermeable to species, whether it's cats or deer or even fence lizards, is going to be a detriment to that species. And the number of species that would be affected, it really is everything from snakes and rodents all the way up to anything that can't fly, whether it's the black bear or the jaguar, and everything in between.
You know, in at least the case of one species, this would be stop cold, the chance, remote or not, just starting to naturally recolonize former habitat.
You're talking about the jaguar.
That's right. There's been a lot of excitement in the last few years about a couple of jaguars, one that famous El Jefe and another more recently, but both cats stoked the hopes that the species might just reestablish itself here in the United States. And they've been photographed and tracked north of the border, living pretty well in Arizona. And we have Mexico to thank for them. Panthera points out that while we in the U.S. have lost breeding populations of jaguars, Mexico has maintained jaguar habitat, jaguars, some of it just 100 miles from the border, what they characterize as a few days' walk for a wandering cat. And that's the source population that's provided us with the famous dispersing male jaguars here. So the Center for Biological Diversity, they've issued a statement, and they say Trump's plan would, quote, end any chance of recovery for endangered jaguars, ocelots, and wolves in the border region.
Well, you know, people who are so concerned about immigration may not care as much about two cats, you know. So what? Just briefly, what are conservationists going to do?
Well, a lot of the conservationists think that the two don't have to be in opposition, but they're doing everything in the meantime, including asking for environmental impact statements, to some saying they'll stand in front of bulldozers if necessary to stop construction.
All right. Well, Vicky Croak, we will keep an eye on this. Vicky Croak reports on all things animal for us at Here and Now. And now, the wall and how it might affect animals. Vicky, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
After 19-year-old Cody Herrera of Idaho pled guilty to the statutory rape of a 14-year-old, a judge resentenced him to a special program and to celibacy for life, or until he gets married, rather than the 5- to 15-year prison sentence he'd received. Let's get a quick check with Alex Riggins, crime and courts reporter at the Times News in Twin Falls, Idaho. Alex, legal experts are saying this law is so obscure it's never been challenged. And if it is now, it probably won't hold up. But we're thinking it's doubtful Cody Herrera will challenge it, because without it, he'd have to do the jail sentence, right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, probation is a contract. And if he decides not to, you know, abide by that contract, then he goes to prison. And so it sounds like it would be tough for him to challenge it.
Right. But how do you know if he's abiding by this charge of celibacy while on probation? I mean, how do you monitor that?
That's kind of the million-dollar question, or I guess for him, the 5- to 15-year question, you know, is how is that enforced? Speaking to a law expert last week, she said, what are they going to do? Are they going to bust in his house and make sure, you know, what he's doing in his bedroom is following the law? You know, maybe they do a polygraph test or something like that every couple months. But other than that, I really don't know how they would enforce this condition.
Yeah, and it's a complicated case. The young girl in this particular case lied about her age, but her mom said she told Cody Herrera the truth. The judge said he put this celibacy penalty in place in part because Herrera told prosecutors he had 34 partners. And prosecutors say he could face more charges related to underage girls. Are people concerned that this is potentially a sexual predator who's being allowed to go out on this sort of how-do-you-monitor-it probation?
Certainly the victim's mom was, concerned. She made a statement and she called him a predator. She said that after the fact he had threatened her daughter and threatened her family with violence, you know, if they went to the police over this. The pre-sentence investigation, the Department of Health and Welfare, who does the interviews and the psychosexual evaluation and that sort of thing, did not consider him a predator. They said he was a low to low moderate risk to reoffend. So it's kind of up in the air, you know, whether he's going to be dangerous in the future or what the case is.
All right. Well, we'll follow this. Alex Riggins, crime and courts reporter at the Times News in Twin Falls, Idaho. Alex, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's brighten up a winter day. Here in our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, joins us from KQED in San Francisco. And Kathy, you have sent us samples of citrus. Thank you. But because?
Well, it's seasonal. I mean, although you can get many citrus fruit all year round, it is picked fresh now till about early spring, April or so. And there are a lot of varieties, some you'll have heard of and some maybe you've never heard of.
Well, for instance, Cara Cara. What is that?
Cara Cara. Oh, boy, do I love that. It looks like a kind of regular old roundish navel orange. But when you cut them open, you see this gorgeous pinkish, almost red-orange flesh. And if you taste that, tell me what you think there. Because to me, It tastes like a cross between a grapefruit and an orange, and I don't want to sound pretentious and like a sommelier or a wine person, but I do taste berry. Berry undertones.
I do, too.
Do you get that?
I do, too. And is this, and I'm probably wrong here, but is this something you might call a blood orange?
No, it's not.
Okay,
it's
even though it's red.
It's an orange. And another nice thing about it is that it's seedless, very low in acidity, great to eat fresh, also really great to cook with. The juice is fabulous. Caracaras are available across the country. They are so well worth looking for.
Okay.
Sumo.
Here it is.
You got the sumo there?
Yeah. It's smaller.
It's a cross between a mandarin and a California navel orange. It's tangy. Mm. It apparently took 30 years to develop in Japan, and they are now grown in California. They're sold mainly on the West Coast, but you can find them in the New York area and on the East Coast. No seeds. Oh. I think they're fabulous.
Well, you could probably special order these from people who send fruits. It is so sweet, so juicy.
Isn't that lovely?
Great. Okay, so that's the sumo. We'll have a list and some pictures at herenow.org. Kishu mandarins.
So first of all, a mandarin and a tangerine are two words for the same thing, essentially. The Kishu mandarin is so adorable. It's like the size of a walnut. Mm-hmm. They're very easy to peel, also seedless, very high natural sugar content. They're so floral and almost like honey. And if you smell them, too, it almost smells like spring blossoms.
They are definitely, well, they're tiny and adorable, as you said.
They're so cute.
Yeah,
so cute.
But they're also milder, much milder than the sumo that I just had, which was so pungent.
So those are the Kishu mandarins. Mm-hmm. And then next to those, you have the Page mandarins, which are also juicy, but not quite as juicy as the Kishu. And I don't know why, but I taste lychee nut. A little bit richer, and this is a great tangerine or mandarin to cook with.
If I'd ever had a lychee nut, I must. It might taste it too. But I'm comparing it back to the sumo, which knocked my socks off. Delicious, hardly any skin. You know, a lot of juice, and
yes,
and yet these are slightly milder than the.
They are.
Sumo.
They're like a mix between like a clementine and a mineola orange.
Okay.
Moving along, mm-hmm. Things are going to get very large. You see the white pomelo. It's the gigantic thing in front of you.
Huge.
It's also called the Chinese grapefruit because it originated in Southeast Asia, and it is the largest of all citrus fruit.
Really?
Very sweet. Tart, but none of the harsh, bitter aftertaste that you find in so many grapefruit. I think they're super tasty.
Yeah, really good.
And those are right in season right now.
Okay. Then you've got little kumquats rolling around here.
Little kumquats. And if you're up to it, you can pop the whole thing in your mouth. They are very tart. There are certain varieties that are better for eating raw than others, but generally they are sweet. The skin is edible. Most people like to cook with them. They're delicious poached in a sugar syrup, and they add a super tart, interesting citrus flavor to all kinds of food.
I was just going to say, keyword there might be tart. I just bit into one.
Did you? Yeah,
it's
no, it's kind of shocking.
Yeah, right.
And there are some seeds, but there's a variety that I tasted out here, a marumi kumquat. It was so sweet. You could just pop these in your mouth all day. Again, like all citrus, so good for you, an incredible source of vitamin C. One orange, Robin. If you eat one orange this winter day, you will get 100% of your recommended dose of vitamin C.
Well, and I'm not sure if they're just as healthy when you candy them. You've got candied orange peel. This looks hard to make.
Well, I thought it was too, and I'm going to tell you the truth. I've never made it before. I see them all the time in these chocolate shops and fancy candy stores, and they cost a small fortune, and I thought, how hard can it be? And in fact, it's quite easy. You take the peel off of any type of orange or tangerine, and you boil it in some water, and you drain it, and you repeat that twice, and then you cook it for the last time in a little bit of sugar and water, and cook it for like 20 minutes, and then you let it dry. And you just toss it with a little sugar, and they keep for months, and they are so delicious on their own for a sweet treat. But you can add them to salads or to a chocolate cake, anything. They're really
delicious.
Fun to make, actually.
Delicious. We'll have a recipe at hereandnow.org. Okay, so two of our producers, Emiko Tamagawa and Karen Miller-Mitson, have put together one of your recipes for a citrus salad. It is stunning. I mean,
isn't it beautiful?
It's not yours, Kathy, but it's pretty darn good.
I bet they did a great job. They did. Because the recipe is so simple. You essentially peel and slice 4 different types of oranges. We used caracara, tangerine, a blood orange, and the sumo or a navel orange. Really, you could use anything you get your hands on. And then this is the trick. You make a vinaigrette with fresh mint and Meyer lemon and toasted walnuts on there. I think in the dead of winter, this citrus salad with the beautiful colors and the bright, fresh flavors of mint and the crunch of walnut and the Meyer lemon vinaigrette is guaranteed to put a smile on your face.
Well, I've got one now, but I've got a question too. Meyer lemon, is that a different?
Meyer lemon is a specific type of lemon. It's not as tart as a regular lemon. And it tastes like a cross between an orange and a lemon. And I personally cannot get enough of this stuff. They're one of my absolute favorite flavors to use in cooking.
Okay, we always learn. Kathy, by the way, we'll have a recipe for roast salmon with tangerines and fennel with an orange butter sauce at hereandnow.org, along with all of these fruits. Talking citrus with Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst. Kathy, thank you as always.
Thanks, Robin.
A crack in Antarctica's 4th largest ice shelf has grown to more than 100 miles long, and scientists say it could soon calve off into one of the largest icebergs ever recorded. A UK-based team of scientists known as Project Midas says the iceberg is likely to break free from Antarctica's Larsen C ice shelf within the next few months. For more, we're joined via Skype by Martin O'Leary, a glaciologist at Swansea University in Wales and a researcher with Project Midas. Martin O'Leary, welcome.
Thank you.
And describe this to us. Where is this ice sheet and how big is the rift?
So Larsen C is on the Antarctic Peninsula, which is the bit of Antarctica that sticks up towards South America. So if you go to the southernmost tip of South America, Tierra del Fuego, and head south for another 1,000 miles or so, you'll be right in the middle of Larsen C. In American terms, it's about the size of West Virginia. It's 50,000 square kilometers. And the iceberg that's coming off is going to be 5,000 or 6,000 square kilometers. We're not exactly sure yet. So there's a rift now, which is 175 kilometers long. That's about 110 miles. And we're expecting that to break through sometime in the next few months.
And it's grown. This rift has grown very quickly just in the last few months, right?
Yes, yes. So we've been tracking it for about 5 years now. It started out, there's a lot of rifts in the southern end of Larsen C. They tend to just form and sit there, and most of them never go anywhere. In 2014, this one started to grow bigger than all of the surrounding ones. So we've been tracking it since then. It grew quite a bit in 2014, was pretty stagnant in 2015, grew again in 2016, and then again twice in the last month or so. So we're really seeing an acceleration of this.
And what's causing it, and how much of it is related to climate change?
It's not related to climate change to the best of our knowledge. So this is a natural process. Ice on its own will tend to fracture. It's a very brittle material. So we don't have a direct link to climate change. That's not to say that there isn't one, but if there is, we're not aware of how it could work. So this is just a natural process. Ice enters these shelves through snow mostly, and it has to go somewhere.
Well, I mean, we know that, for example, over the last couple of years, that the Earth has seen its warmest years on record. So wouldn't that be a direct connection to climate change? It warms up, the ice starts to crack a little bit more than it did before, or is that there's no connection there?
Well, certainly it's been very warm in this area of Antarctica recently, but we don't have a causal connection here. We can't draw that link. Ice does not break more when it becomes warm. It certainly thins, and we've seen a little bit of that, but not enough to explain this crack. I think this is more or less part of a very long natural cycle.
So what happens when it breaks off? What are the consequences?
Well, we're going to see an iceberg, as we say, about 5,000 or 6,000 square kilometers, size of Delaware, roughly. That's going to float away, drift out into the ocean, maybe break up, maybe melt away. We don't really know what's going to happen with that. In terms of a geographical change, this will be Larsen C in its most its smallest situation ever. We've never seen it quite this small. It varies in size a lot as icebergs form and break off, but this will be the smallest ever. Or at least the smallest on record.
Does it cause the sea level to rise?
No, it won't. So The ice is already floating, so it's already made any contribution to sea level that it's going to make. Obviously, we've got some concern that as Larsen C breaks up, we would expect to see the glaciers behind Larsen C start to accelerate. And those will start to put ice into the ocean, which wasn't floating, and so those will contribute to sea level rise. But even if that does happen, it's going to be a relatively small effect, maybe a millimeter or two.
And what about the possibility that this could regrow in a way, that the ice could reform?
Certainly, yes. Over time, what happens is more ice comes in at the back of the shelf and that pushes the front forward. And we could see a return to a similar ice front position that we see now. That would probably take a few decades to a century. But what we're concerned with is that while the ice is in this retreated position, then the effects of climate change could lead it to become less stable.
When you put this together with the melting that we're also seeing in other places on Earth, including Greenland and the North Pole, and then in other parts of Antarctica, are you concerned generally, though, that we're seeing more ice melting or breaking off and that that's going to have consequences?
Oh, certainly, yes. I mean, globally, we are losing ice at an incredible rate, both land ice, which is what I study, and sea ice, which is something which has changed dramatically in the last year. I don't think this particular event is cause for concern, but the general pattern is certainly worrying.
That's Martin O'Leary, who is a glaciologist at Swansea University in the UK and a researcher with Project MIDAS. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And while we're talking about melting ice, an archaeologist says organic artifacts that have been preserved in ice in Yellowstone National Park are being lost as temperatures rise. These are things like pollen, pine needles, sticks, bones, even dung that have been trapped in the ice maybe for thousands of years. An archaeologist for Yellowstone says ice patches in the park have protected the evidence of an earlier time, but the rate at which that ice has been melting has been rising drastically in the last 10 years.
Means it's exposing those things, too,
yeah.
Bones and stuff. Wow.
Here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.